Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer, who joins us to chat about the projections unveiled at this week's Ag Outlook Forum. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Supreme Court rejected a petition from Tyson Foods to move a case involving worker deaths due to COVID-19 to the federal level. The decision keeps the case at a state court in Iowa. Tyson argued moving the case to federal jurisdiction was justified since the company was working to keep a Waterloo, Iowa plant operating under an executive order from former President Donald Trump. The lawsuit alleges negligence and disregard for safety contributed to the deaths of four employees at the plant after the workers contracted COVID-19. The Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance rolled out 109 Farm Bill priorities focused on helping farmers and landowners deal with climate change. The recommendations come from the coalition's mix of agricultural and environmental groups. Among the top priorities are expanded conservation technical assistance and streamlining ways for producers to implement climate-smart ag practices. FACA also calls on Congress to make sure the more than $18 billion earmarked for conservation programs in last year's Inflation Reduction Act is spent on its intended purpose. And finally today, farm economy experts gathered in the D.C. Beltway for the USDA Ag Outlook Forum. The annual event serves as the first look at USDA's projections for the financial picture crop and livestock producers will face in the upcoming year. This year was no exception, as Chief Economist Seth Meyer started the event by detailing a year of lower farm income, growth in planted acres, and stubborn input costs across the board. To kick off our conversation with Meyer, we asked him how he would assess the current health of the ag economy.
2023 is shaping up to be a good year, and that's following 2022, which was a great year. It would have been really hard to maintain that level of aggregate farm income for an additional year. So, yeah, it's lower than last year, but still going to be above the long-term trend. It's going to be above an above-average year. I think we'll continue to have some uncertainty. You know, we look at global stock levels, et cetera. We've seen price volatility in the past, but look, shaping up to be a pretty good year.
And looking globally at the issue of, and specifically within the wheat complex, but even more broadly than that, you mentioned the Black Sea Grain Initiative, and that's a situation where looking at the near-term expiration or need for renewal of that deal. But I wonder, just from a global trade standpoint, what would be the implications of that deal falling through?
I think this is a important, it is an important agreement. But it does not get the Ukrainians back to pre-war levels of exports. But it does put some additional grain back on the market, puts additional corn and wheat back on the market. That helps moderate global prices. So it is incredibly important for that to continue to moderate prices. If it were to expire, I think we'd, if they couldn't reach an agreement, I think that we'd see a couple things happen. We've already seen Ukrainian producers trim production to try and kind of match what they can actually export. They would take another leg down in production. We'd see commodity prices move back up because now we're taking grain back out of the global market. So I think that while the Black Sea Grain Initiative does not get them back to pre-war levels, it is a key component to kind of keeping a lid on agricultural commodity prices, and in particular wheat.
We'll be right back with more from USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack has been pushing the idea of expanding profit opportunities for producers beyond the sale of conventional crops and livestock. USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer says the idea has potential, but more needs to be known.
The secretary talks strongly about diversifying your lots of income streams, more income streams, different income streams, not eliminating any past income streams, just adding to them additional opportunities. I think a lot of this is consumer driven. I think a lot of it is the consumer saying they want this product. I think farmers are really good at delivering what the consumer wants. What do you want? I'll make it for you as long as you're paying for this. I'm a market-oriented person. The consumer wants something, the consumer is willing to pay up. I think there's great potential there to deliver to the consumers what they want. I think another aspect of what the secretary points out is the ability or the opportunity to capture value farther up the chain as well, too. Can I market directly to schools? Can I market directly to restaurants, to consumers? And can I capture some of that marketing value? That'll work for some producers and it won't work for others. Other producers might have the ability to say consumers at some location or a processor wants a climate smart commodity. I can do that. I am small only in geography in that I am small and I have a small amount of land, but I want to be big when it comes to income streams. I think that's a very reasonable desire for some producers to maximize the value of their land. And I think that production of energy on the land, production of environmental services, the production of, you know, making more closer direct connection to your consumers. So I think that there is a lot of potential there for producers who may be more limited in their land holdings, or maybe closer to those kind of opportunities, who may be willing to experiment with different production practices.
So understanding that there's a lot that we still need to learn about just what this, you know, new system could potentially look like, the buyers and sellers, et cetera, what do you need to know from an economic standpoint before you can put kind of some hard numbers on what the individual producer profit potential looks like?
I'm an economist, so I'm a numbers person. I always like numbers, and I think you're absolutely right. So when the secretary talks about, well, we've got these climate smart commodity network and this program, and we're going to figure out how to match consumers to producers for these climate smart commodities, my mind initially goes to, well, this network is going to gather all the information about what were the challenges? What's the actual environmental benefits? How can we quantify them? How can we assure consumers that they're getting the end product attribute that they want? And how can producers gain value from it? So to me, the most interesting part of the Climate Smart Commodities Network, this program, this network of businesses who are operating in this area that we're funding or co-funding, is what we're going to learn out of this, what we're going to monitor, measure, record, and verify, MMRV. And I think that's the most important aspect. You got to be able to measure it. You got to be able to assure consumers that they're getting what they say they want.
So I want to wrap up here talking on the demand side of things. We've talked a lot about American producers and their production, their exports, things of that nature. But as we look at things from a domestic consumer standpoint, how are you anticipating macroeconomic factors like inflation, continued recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic? How do you anticipate all of those factors will combine to impact the kinds of disposable income that will lead to, you know, additional food purchases beyond, you know, emergency staples?
I talked about in my speech that, hey, we're producing a lot of meat, a little less this year, but we're still producing a lot of meat and demand's been really robust. So I do have some concerns about where we land. Is it a soft economic landing? I think I'm feeling a little bit better about a soft economic landing in terms of the Fed's actions and their need to raise interest rates. I mean, we're still getting lots of mixed signals within the economy about is inflation coming down and are we going to hit our target? Are we going to have to be more aggressive? Will we have been too aggressive? I'm feeling a little bit better that we'll get it closer to right. And we're seeing some good signs where, you know, consumer savings rates have stopped falling and maybe they've kind of eased back up. And to some extent, that tells me consumers are feeling a little bit better and are a little bit better about their situation. So again, I'm hopeful that we'll see a somewhat soft landing. Inflation is coming down. Food prices are still rising, but the rate of the rise continues to slow. I think we'll continue to see that. At the same time, we'll continue to see things that surprise us, like egg prices from HPAI. So there are still events which can happen to affect that. But I think we're easing into a better place in inflation. I think I'm a bit more optimistic that we'll see a tapering of action by the Fed, and we'll a soft landing seems more probable to me than it did before.
99th Ag Outlook Forum this year. Anything you can tell us about big plans, big expectations for number 100?
Only that we'll start planning on Monday morning. And I invite you all to attend in person and virtually next year.
Very good. USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pegel checks in on some important figures from a key nutrition program in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Participation in a well-known government food program is dropping as we head into reauthorization of nutrition language in the upcoming Farm Bill. USDA's Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, most commonly known as WIC, works to reduce food insecurity for low-income mothers and children under the age of 5. Children make up roughly half of all WIC participants. But fewer Americans are applying for WIC benefits. This chart shows WIC participation levels over the last 15 fiscal years. Signups peaked in 2010 at more than 9.1 million women and children. But by fiscal year 2022, enrollment had dropped nearly 32% from the program highs. The Biden administration has proposed a slate of changes to WIC, including language that would get more fruits and vegetables to participants. But the dairy industry is pushing back on a provision that would cut the amount of its products a WIC beneficiary is allotted. Jackie Fatka dives deeper in her coverage on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Don't miss the must-attend policy event of the year. Register now for the 2023 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Hear from the diverse players who are trying to influence legislation and investment decisions as we examine the forward-looking ideas that will drive policy discussions for this year and the decades ahead. The summit takes place on March 20th at the National Press Club in Washington and through our virtual experience. View the agenda and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Going to continue our conversation now on the agricultural economics projections that we're discussing on this week's show and at this week's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum. Joined this week by Krista Swanson with the National Corn Growers Association, as well as Scott Irwin with the University of Illinois. Appreciate both of you taking the time to join us. And Scott, I want to go to you first, because obviously unveiling a lot of projections this time of year as we look ahead to the upcoming planting season, the upcoming crop and livestock production season. I wonder, when you think about the vast array of economic indicators that somebody in your profession can follow, anything in particular kind of jumping out at you that is telling you what to expect this upcoming year?
Well, I think one of the key sets of numbers will be U.S. total planted acreage to major crops. The USDA came out with their first forecast this morning at the Ag Outlook Forum, and that's going to set the size of the U.S. supply base going forward for the upcoming crop year. I tend to be on a little bit of what might be called the heavy side of acreage projections relative to the USDA, but I think they're pretty close to in line that we're going to be someplace around 180 million acres combined corn and soybean planted acreage this year.
So we look at those USDA figures, they're looking at about 91 million corn acres, about 87.5 million on the soybean side. And so right now we're still seeing corn is king from a planted acreage standpoint, and that's something that has been the case for a while. But there are some that project that could potentially switch at a certain point in time due to robust demand from things like renewable diesel, sustainable aviation fuel, a lot of increased crush capacity, a lot of uses for soybeans in the United States and around the world. We haven't seen that yet. At what point do you think is a realistic inversion point to be watching there?
Well, I'm on the maybe pragmatic middle on the whole debate about the need for soybeans and soybean oil in the midst of this renewable diesel boom. There's a lot of moving parts here. And I think the way I would put it, I'm not on the side. Some people think we need 20 million more acres of soybeans in the next 5 or 10 years. I'm not that extreme. I think we're just going to see kind of the continued pressure that we've seen towards equalization of corn and soybean planted acreage here in the U.S. There's lots of other sources of feedstock for renewable diesel and sustainable aviation fuel. And I think that you just simply can't get the pricing of the soybean complex too out of line from those other sources before you'll see substitution to those other sources.
Well, and Krista, obviously there's been a lot of conversation about the increased potential demand for soybeans as a result of some of these growing biofuel markets, renewable diesel, sustainable aviation fuel among them. When we look specifically at the corn complex, what are the big demand drivers that you're watching for that particular crop?
Like you said, I guess to follow up on what Scott was talking about on the soybean side with renewable diesel, you know, sustainable aviation fuel could be a big demand driver on the corn side. Like Scott said, we have to keep an eye on that because at some point it can, substitutions can happen. So that's definitely something that we're keeping an eye on and, you know, hoping to see that, you know, start to utilize some more of our corn. As far as the Ag Outlook Forum that's going on right now and the long-term projections report, USDA is showing for the upcoming year increased feed demand. So that's a positive for us as well. On the ethanol side, their projection is flat. Ethanol is a challenge for us just because, gas consumption is flat, and you know, looking ahead into the future, if we see a greater transition to electric vehicles, the market for that fuel is declining. And so to get more ethanol in, this is why, you know, from a policy perspective for us, it's really important to see, and we're pushing for higher ethanol blends so we can continue to have that as a demand driver for corn as well.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of our space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Welcome back. NCGA economist Krista Swanson says while the organization is keeping a close eye on the politics of the U.S.-Mexico corn situation, it's not yet factoring into economic forecasts.
I will note that in USDA's long-term projections that it's not accounted for in there. Whenever those projections were started, that was not really, Mexico had indicated this coming, but it hadn't ramped up like it has here in the past month or so. It's definitely something that we're keeping an eye on and studying and looking at, how that's going to impact our corn farmers across the country. And, something that we're working very hard to get resolved and reach a resolution with Mexico as well, because that they are such a critical trading partner.
Mm-hmm. Looking around the rest of the world, is there room for additional market penetration in other areas? Should Mexico, if we accept the potential doomsday scenario here for the American corn producer, should Mexico stop buying American GMO corn? Is there room for market penetration elsewhere?
Yeah, definitely. China is always that, they have been buying more corn, and we would like to continue to grow in that space. We also have, other areas where we can, increase exports. And so that's something that's important. Although I will note that as much as we want to get the Mexico situation resolved, I think that we may see some adjustment in trade flow patterns, but you know, as of right now, they still are willing to, you know, this decree does not impact yellow corn, which is a large percent of what we export to Mexico. So while we do find it critical to get a resolution to this, it's not necessarily a situation where Mexico is completely being removed as a trading partner.
Yes, important to note the traffic could still continue headed south of the border for American corn producers. And Scott, I want to wrap up the conversation with you because as we look at a number of the demand drivers that we've discussed here so far today, things like biofuels, things like trade, one that Secretary Vilsack has pushed pretty hard is a potential additional value-added sales through carbon sequestration, other means of generating income outside of traditional commodity sales. I wonder, what do the economics tell us at this point about the market and the income potential for American producers from that kind of a shift within the ag economy?
Well, there's a lot of discussion on that point, but the market values have not really been determined very well. We have a real issue with basically measuring carbon removal in a way that can be monetized. I don't see a lot of people working on it, so there's progress, but there's big challenges on the measurement front before you can really trade it and make earnings on it. But it's certainly going to be a potential growth area for value-added income in the future. Just in the last couple of days, California is making noise of tightening down their carbon emission standards, and that's kind of the bellwether in terms of carbon pricing in the United States. So definitely something to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on, as you said, as we watch a number of the different economic factors that are going to be facing American producers this year. A lot of folks getting ready to head into planting season in the southern part of the country. Some are already there, and we'll be keeping a very close eye on the prices they're getting, the production that they're doing throughout the rest of the year. But Krista and Scott, appreciate you joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Lydia Johnson takes a look at the Farm Bill process across the country in this week's Map It Out.
Congress is picking up the pace in its review of the 2018 Farm Bill. Lawmakers have been all over the country as the process for writing the next Farm Bill gets underway. House and Senate Ag Committee leaders hit the road for listening sessions and field hearings that allow for direct feedback on the legislation. This map shows the locations for two Senate Ag field hearings and seven House Ag listening sessions for the upcoming Farm Bill that have taken place over the past 10 months. Several members have also held individual conversations in addition to the events organized by committee leadership. The events give local producers, farm organizations, nutrition advocates, and others a chance to call attention to their priorities, which may be specific to the geography of where the gathering is taking place. Senate Ag is also holding additional hearings on Capitol Hill during the 118th Congress. Lawmakers have held hearings so far on nutrition, crop insurance, trade, and other topics, and we'll gather next week to discuss conservation language. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson.
Don't miss the must-attend policy event of the year. Register now for the 2023 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Hear from the diverse players who are trying to influence legislation and investment decisions as we examine the forward-looking ideas that will drive policy discussions for this year and the decades ahead. The summit takes place on March 20th at the National Press Club in Washington and through our virtual experience. View the agenda and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The Ag Committees in both chambers will be getting together. House Ag will convene Tuesday morning for a hearing on challenges facing American agriculture, and Senate Ag will hold a hearing Wednesday morning on Farm Bill conservation programs. And be on the lookout for our Steve Davies at the National Ethanol Conference in Orlando, Florida. Stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for all of this and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one. Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.